This is Far From Home. I'm Scott Gurian. If you've been following the news, you might have seen the headlines over the past week about the violence that's broken out in Northern Ireland, which was the worst it's been in many years. During one skirmish in Belfast last Wednesday night, rioters threw Molotov cocktails, several police officers were injured, and a double-decker bus was burnt to the ground. It was the latest flare-up in long simmering tensions between Catholic nationalists who are calling for a united Ireland and Protestant loyalists and unionists who remain dedicated to the British crown. The story of how we got here is pretty long and complicated, and I wanted to understand it for myself. So a few years ago, I visited Belfast and produced a documentary in collaboration with the podcast 99% Invisible. The short summary is that there was this bloody conflict, often referred to as the Troubles, that lasted from the late 1960s until the signing of the Good Friday Peace Agreement in 1998. But even though it's now been more than two decades since the fighting officially ended, there are still these giant peace walls separating many Catholic and Protestant communities, and many of the wounds have yet to be fully healed. In light of everything that's taken place over the past week, I figured now would be a good time to re-release that episode, and it's a good one, so if you haven't heard it, you should definitely stay tuned. But first, to get some context on the latest developments, I spoke a few days ago with my colleague Don Duncan, who's a journalist based in Northern Ireland and a lecturer at Queen's University in Belfast. Since the situation in the region has appeared relatively calm in recent years, at least from an outsider perspective, I began by asking him what changed.
I suppose there's been a narrative of progress since the Good Friday Agreement was signed, that it's been a huge success and it's a shining star around the world for peace building and reconciliation. And, you know, there are a lot of positives from it. But if you start looking closer at aspects of the Northern Irish story in the last 23 years, you start to see that it's not as rosy as some would have you think. And I think what's happened over the last week in Northern Ireland, in Belfast particularly, these riots, as they're being called, or these outpouring of anger, that's a real testament to underlying and persisting division that is not armed and is not shooting at each other, that kind of thing, but is persistent and has been there for long before the Troubles and has remained there between specific communities. And there is a whole sort of sector of the society that hasn't really benefited from the peace process, that hasn't gotten a dividend of the peace. And quite typically, it's people that are disadvantaged socioeconomically in both communities on both sides of the divide. That hasn't gone away.
From the reporting I've heard, it sounds like the particular event that may have sparked this violence was the funeral a while back of a former member of the Irish Republican Army. And that caused this big uproar because it included a large procession of Catholic nationalist politicians in violation of the COVID-19 protocols there. And it took place at the same time that people from the Protestant loyalist community were being told that large gatherings like that weren't allowed. So they viewed it as kind of a double standard. But sparks don't just cause combustion on their own. They, of course, need tinder to ignite. So give us some more of the context of what else was happening beneath the surface that led up to the events of these past few days.
Yeah, there's several factors. So one is definitely that funeral where senior figures of Sinn Féin, which is the political party that is the biggest, largest nationalist political party, attended. And there was a deliberation, I believe, last week by the police service of Northern Ireland that they would not be prosecuted under COVID lockdown restrictions. That decision enraged the loyalist population. And this really plugs into a sense that has been growing since the end of the Troubles and the beginning of the peace process, that there's a two-tier police service that feels to them like discrimination or a demotion. So that's one factor, Scott. Another factor is Brexit and a part of the Brexit negotiation that guarantees that Northern Ireland will stay within the European Union in a trading sense.
And let me just jump in here if I can, because it's a bit complicated. So I want to make sure listeners follow along and understand what this means. Yeah. So first of all, Northern Ireland's, of course, part of the UK, but it's on a separate island from England, Scotland, and Wales. And it shares this land border with the Republic of Ireland. The UK left the European Union when Brexit took effect at the end of January, which meant they had to start doing customs checks for stuff being shipped to and from most of the rest of Europe. But Ireland, like the country of Ireland, is still in the EU. So that basically left two options. The UK government could have built customs checkpoints all along the border of Ireland and Northern Ireland. But, you know, given the complicated political history, pretty much everyone on all sides agreed that, you know, that was a really bad idea, since it risked raising tensions among people who've pretty much gotten used to living, traveling, and doing business freely across this totally open border for all these years. The other option, which they chose instead, was to continue to keep the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland totally open through a special arrangement, but to treat Northern Ireland different from the rest of the UK. So things like meat, milk, and eggs getting shipped between Great Britain and Northern Ireland now have to be inspected when they arrive at Northern Ireland airports and seaports. You know, it's sort of like a big extra bureaucratic step, and the loyalists in Northern Ireland really don't like it.
Yeah, unionists and loyalists are seeing this as, you know, a separation or a step away from the United Kingdom towards United Ireland. And yes, they're still like an integral part of the UK in terms of sovereignty and territory. But instead of having a trade border on the island of Ireland, they've put it down the Irish Sea between Great Britain and the island of Ireland. That has added fuel to the fire. And then a third factor is that the police has started cracking down on drug gangs in Northern Ireland, and the ones that they cracked down on happened to be connected with loyalist paramilitaries. So that was seen, again, fire the flames of police injustice. So there's kind of several coexisting narratives, and they're all kind of true. And I can't parse it. I can't say how much of which. But I can say that this is not a surprise. When this happened, nobody was like, oh my God, what's going on? The idea of Tinder, and that this isn't a sudden flash, that there's been conditions on the ground here. And you know what? Like, if you talked to me a year ago, these were the fears that people had about Brexit, that like, if we don't do this right, things will start popping off in Northern Ireland. And now we're looking at it, and it's like, it feels like this was sort of prophesied in some way. And, you know, we're seeing things that we haven't seen since the Troubles, like burning buses. That's a very sort of resonant image for people that have lived through the Troubles. And you're seeing young people that were not alive during the Troubles channeling some kind of anger that they have and responding by basically destroying property in their own areas.
Just to make sure I understand kind of how Brexit fits in with all this, we hear about things like customs checks at Northern Ireland's seaports or whatever. And I have to say, it all seems on the face of it like, you know, this theoretical discussion of political implications. So am I missing something? Like, is Brexit actually trickling down and having real world impacts on people in communities like Shankill, where, you know, these riots took place?
Not really. I mean, there's been a little bit of impact in terms of there's certain products are not available anymore in Northern Ireland because retailers in mainland UK just don't think it's worth the bother of putting it through customs. But it's mostly a symbolic change. We're still in this easing stage of Brexit. It's a transition stage, and the full brunt of what Brexit will mean in Northern Ireland actually hasn't hit yet. But if you put this in the context as well of a changing demographic in Northern Ireland, where the Catholic nationalist population has been growing for decades, and we've had the most recent election, the Unionist Party did not get an absolute majority and did not get the highest number of votes. There's been writing on the wall that points towards a united Ireland. There's a lot of discussion in the Republic now about we need to start preparing ourselves, preparing the road for this inevitable unification. Because in the Good Friday Agreement, there is a, you know, a mechanism for a popular vote, both north and south of the border, for reunification if the majority would want that. So this is in the ether, and then you get the UK government, which loyalists are loyal to, it's in their name, that's what they're loyal to, that government decides to draft up, to co-author this regulation with the EU and sign it, which puts customs like posts, I suppose, at seaports in Northern Ireland. So if you're a loyalist and you're already a bit jittery about a perceived loss of power because of peace, right? And then this demographic shift, Brexit, and then this huge uptake in talking about United Ireland as a serious thing, like mainstream parties are talking about it, whereas 5 years ago, it was just like a radical discussion. When you start seeing these border posts, that feels very real.
Well, that's a bit scary then. If all, you know, this violence is already happening just from the symbolic changes. I mean, what about when kind of people start to feel real world impacts in their daily lives? That seems to be ominous.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit, I mean, how are we going to have measured and calm discussions about any kind of transition in the future if this kind of thing happens when there's just, like, nothing has actually changed to the constitutional arrangement in Northern Ireland and we've got this happening. At the same time, Scott, this is a micro aspect of Northern Ireland and it's a tiny, tiny minority that have kicked up. Like, we're talking about, you know, I wouldn't say more than 100 people, really, or like 200 people. It's really not a lot of people, but they're doing stuff that's very resonant. And of course, it's getting huge coverage on TV, and it's been going on now for about a week. But the fact that it hasn't sort of spread and, you know, escalated and become this big thing is also, I suppose, a testament to how the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland voted in a referendum 23 years ago to end violence, and most of them have seen the benefits of that and do not want to give that up. I mean, there's no sense that this is going to, you know, collapse into out-and-out warfare. There'll be a return of the Troubles, but it's a worrying symptom. One way of looking at it is these are areas that have been ignored for many, many years, and now they're kicking up in a way that is not possible to ignore them anymore. And a big, big part of this is poverty and socioeconomic exclusion. And it's, you know, it is about identity, it is about politics, but it's also about deprivation and, you know, political ineptitude, and it's about Brexit and what that means in these poor areas of Belfast, which are like among the poorest areas in the UK. I mean, Northern Ireland is quite socioeconomically disadvantaged. It's the poorest part of the UK, basically, of the four nations in the UK. And these parts that you're seeing on TV, for example, are the poorest parts of Belfast.
So to be clear, when we look back on this moment now, do you think it will just be seen as kind of a momentary setback for the Irish peace process? Or could this potentially be more significant than that?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I don't know if I would look at this as a setback. This could be, like I said, an opportunity to reassess and to reevaluate and not forget how important that agreement was that was signed 23 years ago. But I wonder if we're actually ready to have this open, generous, collaborative discussion about the future of the island. And I would say, I suppose, like the events of the last week would suggest that, you know, at least for some, we aren't. Living in Northern Ireland, I can see the sort of up-close stuff that is not covered, that people not very far away, and I mean people in Dublin, don't even know about the lack of progress that's been made. We always hear about the good side of the Good Friday Agreement. We don't hear about where no progress has been made. And that's going to really come into play when we start talking about reunification in a concrete way. So I worry about that. I mean, I think it's a wake-up call, and I think it's reinforcing a kind of an idea that I had, that a lot of work needs to be done in Northern Ireland before any furniture starts getting moved around.
Thanks so much to Don Duncan for that sobering analysis. I'll admit that before I visited Belfast back in April of 2019, I knew very little about the region or its history. I mean, I had this vague notion, like I think a lot of people, that there'd been some sort of conflict in the past, but that it was all over now. Everyone had moved on, and things were more or less back to normal. So I was surprised to find out that in many ways that was very much not the case. Many people I met still had vivid memories of what it was like to live through the Troubles, which for them was far from ancient history. So on this episode of Far From Home, I'm going to share with you some of what I learned. As I mentioned earlier, today's show was produced in collaboration with my colleagues at one of my favorite podcasts called 99% Invisible, which documents important but overlooked architecture and design that shapes the world. Here's 99PI host Roman Mars.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
Good evening. A historic day at Stormont. After 2 years of talks and after a generation of bloodshed and decades of division and acrimony, a new era of peace. An agreement.
In 1998, political leaders in Northern Ireland signed a peace agreement. They hoped it would end the sectarian violence between Catholics and Protestants, who'd been fighting each other for decades.
At the root of the conflict was the question of whether Northern Ireland should reunite with the rest of Ireland or whether it should remain part of the United Kingdom.
That's Scott Gurian. He's the creator of the Far From Home podcast.
Most Catholics were nationalists, meaning they wanted to govern themselves as part of a united Ireland. Most Protestants were loyalists, also called unionists, who felt a stronger allegiance to the British crown. Paramilitaries on both sides had carried out kidnappings, bombings, and assassinations. More than 3,000 people had died.
but the peace accord aimed to end that violence.
Well, I look forward equally to a new era of friendship and reconciliation between unionists and nationalists, in which each tradition can learn truly the value of the other.
That was more than 20 years ago. And while the political situation in Northern Ireland is certainly better today, it's hard to say that friendship and reconciliation are the norm. Northern Ireland remains divided. In some cases, quite literally.
So, on your left, you can see the wall.
The big brick wall, yeah.
Yes. So here we have a physical interface that separates two communities. Okay.
This is Ian McLaughlin. He's part of the Lower Shankill Community Association, which works to improve conditions in his neighborhood. He took me on a tour of Belfast, Northern Ireland's capital city, where he lives and works.
The wall that we're at now, Scott, is called the Million Brick Wall, because there's exactly a million bricks in it. You have a Protestant community on your left, and you have a Catholic community on your right.
There are so many walls like this in Belfast, which physically separate Protestant neighborhoods from Catholic ones. Ian showed me short walls and tall walls. Some are more like fences that you could see through, while others are made of bricks and steel. Many have clearly been reinforced over time, a cinder block wall topped with corrugated iron, topped with razor wire stretching up towards the sky.
Here we have the Protestant community on the left, hidden behind a security wall with metal fence.
There's even a wall right near Ian's house.
So I live here.
Is this where you grew up?
Yep.
Could we perhaps get out here a moment? Is that okay?
It's a tidy neighborhood of modest brick homes. Two blocks away, the street dead ends at a combination wall and fence that's 30 feet tall. Ian explains it's been there ever since 1972, when he was 11 years old.
So do you remember when this wall went up? Like, do you have clear memories of when they were building it?
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember?
Well, I remember that you had almost a 24-hour constant military or police presence in these streets, because at that time, the opportunity to engage in physical violence presented itself every day and every night, because there was no physical barrier between people. So that's why the things were created in the first instance. It was designed to prevent physical interaction.
In Northern Ireland, there seems to be a euphemism for everything. The walls are called peace lines. The neighborhoods they cut through are called interface areas. And the period when many of the walls went up was a violent time in the 1970s and 80s that everybody just calls the Troubles.
Decades later, you'd think the walls would have come down, but they haven't. Almost all of the walls remain. They cut across communities, like monuments to the conflict, etched into the physical landscape. And removing them isn't going to be easy.
It could be that perhaps at one of these barriers or structures, you lost a loved one, you lost a husband, a partner, a brother, and you have never had closure for that. So that event that happened 40 or 42 years ago, it may as well have happened 4 years ago for some people. Because they live yesterday, every day, every day, every day.
The Irish conflict goes back hundreds of years, and it can be tough to pinpoint exactly when it began.
But for our purposes, let's begin this history lesson in 1922. That's when, after decades of demands for self-governance and a bloody guerrilla war, Ireland gained its independence from the UK, with its capital in Dublin. Around the same time, the island was partitioned, with six counties in the north remaining part of the United Kingdom, forming Northern Ireland.
Protestant loyalists were the majority there, and they went about creating a social and political framework to make sure they remained in power. A framework that much of the Catholic population found inherently unfair and even discriminatory.
You couldn't vote if you didn't own your own property, own a business, but then you couldn't get access to business and property if you didn't get access to money, and you couldn't get access to money if you couldn't get a job, and you couldn't get a job necessarily because you were a Catholic.
Johnny Byrne is a senior lecturer at Ulster University.
So, you know, Catholics didn't have senior positions in the civil service, for example, didn't have access necessarily to further education, and they couldn't change the system because they couldn't vote in people from the particular background that they came from.
Though the two groups lived close to each other, it was like they were in totally different worlds. Here's Ian McLaughlin again.
I had, sadly, no interaction whatsoever with kids from a Catholic background, no.
Protestant families like Ian's sent their kids to the state-run schools, while Catholic children mostly attended schools run by the church. And each group usually lived in separate neighborhoods with people of their own kind.
Well, the communities had their own many infrastructures. You had your own shops, you had your own schools to go to.
Which meant that Catholics and Protestants could live their whole lives without really knowing anyone from the other community. This segregation meant sectarian divides just got deeper and deeper.
My grandparents were very, very militant, unionist, and anti-Catholic.
And Ian still remembers some of the things they used to say.
You know, this is what we're always going to have in the country with these people. We need to drive them into the sea. And I suppose the alarming thing today, when I think about it, was that they actually meant it. They physically meant that. Drive these people into the sea, you know. How can you live here with these people?
Those kinds of anti-Catholic attitudes had real and serious effects on people's lives.
Well, I remember the first job application I applied for.
This is Joe O'Donnell. He grew up in a Catholic nationalist household, and he considered himself Irish, not British. And on that first job application he filled out, it asked for his nationality.
I wrote down Irish, and my mother was reading over the job application, and she says, "You better change that. You'd never get that job." And she was right. I didn't.
By the late 1960s, the list of Catholic grievances had gotten pretty long. Not only were they discriminated against in employment, they didn't have equal access to public housing, and gerrymandering reduced their political influence. But their demands for change were met with strong and sometimes violent loyalist resistance. So after being frustrated with the slow pace of progress, they began to protest in the streets.
But change wouldn't come easily to Northern Ireland. The police responded to the marches with arrests and imprisonments, which only made the protests grow larger.
Eventually, the protests turned into riots, which in turn sparked more riots. Especially in urban areas like Belfast, Catholics and Protestants live right on top of each other, making the situation even more explosive.
I can recall various incidents as a young child.
Ian McLaughlin remembers going to a shop with his mom.
And someone came in and said, "You have 10 minutes to get out of the shop." As a kid, I turned around and saw two guys, balaclavas on, and one of them had a gun and the other one set a bomb on the table. And within 5 minutes, that shop just blew up around everybody. So, I mean, killings were happening at a very rapid rate, and it was almost an everyday occurrence.
In Belfast, the British Army is once again back in the old routine. Men in the middle, keeping peace between two warring factions. But this time, it's not Aden, Cyprus, or some far-off colony. It is, incredibly, in Britain's own backyard, Northern Ireland.
By 1969, the British military was dispatched to Belfast to maintain order. But many people had already started taking matters into their own hands. Residents in Ian's neighborhood of Shankill started building makeshift barricades between the two communities. They used burnt-out cars, construction debris, rubble from vacant houses, and basically whatever materials they could find to protect themselves from the other side.
Finally, after a summer of unrest, Northern Ireland's Prime Minister had had enough. On September 9th, 1969, Major James Chichester Clark went on television and made an announcement.
"We have now decided that the army will erect and man a firm peace line to be sited between the Divis Street area and the Shankill Road on a line determined by a representative body from the City Hall."
In conjunction, by firm peace line, he meant that the army would dismantle the barriers the residents had built and replace them with a more official-looking 5-foot-tall barbed wire fence. Construction began the following day.
The army moved in to build their peace line on the site of the Protestant barricade. Work proceeded smoothly.
The Shankill peace line was meant to be a strictly temporary measure. The thinking was that the barrier would give people on both sides a chance to cool down and stop the violence. One British army major predicted that the fence would be gone by Christmas.
But things didn't go quite according to plan. Instead of being removed, that barbed wire fence was later replaced with corrugated iron sheeting that was twice as high, and the army even added observation posts and floodlights.
10 months later, the army put up a second iron wall between two neighborhoods in North Belfast, again insisting that it was just a temporary measure. But it turned out things were just getting started. Here's lecturer Johnny Byrne again.
So the whole plan was to get the communities to talk and then to start taking the walls down. But then what happened was we normalized the policy. From 1969 onwards, our response to violence, or the threat of violence, was physical segregation.
Even as the walls went up, the fighting continued. And as the fighting continued, the response was to build more walls. They were an imperfect solution, but Byrne thinks they probably prevented things from being even worse.
The reality is, and I don't support it, but segregation works. If you've got two communities who live feet apart, with members of them who are threatening to kill each other, who both feel vulnerable, who both feel fearful, who are asking the state to do something in response, then a physical wall limits the opportunities for both communities to meet each other and to engage in violence and disorder.
Over the next two decades, the government and private landowners constructed close to 100 additional barriers in communities across Northern Ireland. Ian remembers how they started sprouting up everywhere.
You know, the state didn't publicly advertise for planning permission to erect these structures. They just went and put these structures in place. So you could have quite literally driven down or walked down a street one day, and the following day you went back to it, there was a structure across the street preventing you from doing the same thing.
One wall even ran through the center of a city park in Duncairn, a formerly dangerous neighborhood of North Belfast.
As far as I know, it's the only park, certainly in Europe, that has a peace fence or any sort of a segregation barrier.
Kieran Shannon grew up nearby in a Catholic nationalist home. The wall is made of corrugated steel and covered with graffiti, and it kind of snakes up and down this grass-covered hill.
And it basically, it cuts the park in two. So where we're standing at the minute, this would be regarded as the Catholic nationalist side. The other side of the fence would be regarded as the Protestant Unionist side, even though it's one park.
Finally, in 1994, it seemed like all the violence and wall building might finally subside. The Provisional Irish Republican Army released a statement agreeing to lay down their weapons.
A cassette of the statement was also handed over.
We are therefore entering into a new situation in a spirit of determination and confidence.
They promised to shift their tactics to political negotiation. The announcement was met with a mix of skepticism and celebration. Many people in Northern Ireland felt it was a historic development.
Which is what makes that wall Kieran showed me in the park all the more remarkable. Because there's one thing I failed to mention.
Do you remember when this wall was put up here?
Yeah, it's an easy date for people to remember because it was the 1st of September 1994 when work started on it. That date is significant because on the 31st of August 1994, the day before, was the day that the IRA announced their ceasefire.
That's right. This wall was built after the ceasefire.
I guess people would hear this story and they would think that's unusual, that the ceasefire was signed, but then the very next day, a new wall is erected. Does that seem strange at all to you?
Well, in the context of the time, it wasn't, you know, because the bitterness between the two sides of our community was still there and was still manifesting itself on the streets.
A few years later, in 1998, the Troubles officially ended with the signing of the peace agreement. But that didn't stop even more walls and fences from going up. At the interfaces between Catholic and Protestant communities, the same old tensions remained. The most recent fence was built in 2013.
Eventually, the government enacted an official policy of wall removal. They even set a target of 2023. But when you talk to people on the ground, there seems to be widespread agreement that the target is completely unrealistic. And it's not even clear if most people want the walls to come down.
One of the newer walls sits in the Whitewell neighborhood of North Belfast. It runs right through Joe Hughes's backyard.
I'm just calling to Jerry's tonight. Hello, how are you?
Hey, good to meet you.
Joe has been surrounded by violence for much of his life. He recalls being a kid and hiding under his bed while gunshots rang out in the streets. His family moved at one point in search of safety, but the new neighborhood was even worse. So after he and his wife got married, they moved yet again to a new house in a new development, and it seemed like finally the situation would improve.
There was a lot to look forward to. So there was, especially, you know, the area being newly built and being mixed.
mixed, meaning a place where people of different backgrounds live together, which was perfect since Joe's Catholic and his wife is Protestant. Their hope was that they could start over with a clean slate in an area that didn't have the sectarian baggage of other places that they lived in the past. And they were hoping to raise their daughters in a non-partisan environment.
Well, we were all for that, you know, as a way forward to bring them up. We wanted them to be able to go anywhere they wanted and not be held back because of religion and bigotry and stuff, which we didn't like because we were never brought up like that ourselves, you know.
But after 4 or 5 years, things got bad again. It was the mid-2000s by now, years after peace had been declared, but summertime violence began to flare up once more. First, Joe's neighbor was attacked, and then he says another incident hit even closer to home. It was nearly midnight, totally dark. Joe and his wife were in bed.
Next thing, we're woken with a bang and it smashed the bottles, then the bricks and getting fire at the windows and stuff.
Three Molotov cocktails, or petrol bombs, as Joe called them, slammed into his back wall. Within minutes, his house was engulfed in flames.
You know, it was quite frightening. So it was, people, you know, could have been killed or burned alive on it.
Joe began to seriously question whether he and his family should leave. He had always been opposed to peace walls in the past. He says he didn't understand them, and he felt they did more harm than good. But now that he had kids, he saw things differently. In the end, it was the construction of a 2-story tall mesh fence that convinced Joe and many of his neighbors that it was safe enough to stay.
This peace wall that we have, it's not intruding on anyone, and it's not ugly in any shape or form. What it does is give us peace of mind. It's important that people do have security.
Joe says almost all the people on his block supported this wall at the time it was built, and the vast majority continue to support it today. Even though Joe says there hasn't been any more violence in the 12 years since it went up, he thinks that's precisely why it needs to remain where it is.
The people in the street have sort of said that they don't want it taken down. They can sleep in their bed at night instead of worrying about when the next attack's coming from.
Take it over?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, check. Are you ready? This is Leah, by the way, Scott.
But not everyone thinks more walls are a good idea. Just down the hill from Joe in the Whitewell neighborhood, Geraldine O'Kane is looking for ways to create a community without them. She works for an organization that's trying to build connections between young people from Protestant and Catholic backgrounds. The whole idea, she says, is that it's hard to throw a stone at a friend.
But her work has sometimes made her a target. 6 years ago, someone snuck into the building where she works with the kids and left an explosive device in the courtyard. A bomb disposal team got rid of it.
Okay. But if the young ones had been in on time, that door was always thrown open and they were allowed to come out here and play.
Wow.
So they had a kick to it, not knowing what it was.
Even as Geraldine drove me around her neighborhood, I could see that the tensions from the past were still very much alive.
On the left-hand side.
Okay.
As you can see, the Union Jacks.
Yeah.
Protestant neighborhood.
Yeah. We have 2 bus stops there. We have a Protestant bus stop and a Catholic bus stop.
So the people, the Protestants and Catholics, wait at separate bus stops, and then they would all get on the same bus, right? But just interesting.
Uh-huh. Wow. Which is crazy.
Geraldine thinks that the walls in her community aren't doing much to stop violence. After all, every wall has a start and end point, so people who are determined can simply go around them. But she argues that there's also a larger symbolic reason for why the walls should be taken down. People who live near peace walls in so-called interface communities actually face a stigma because of it. These communities tend to be the most economically deprived in the region.
People, they judge you kind of. You know, they go, oh God, how do you live in that interface? You're going, yeah. And there's a difference of the way they chat to you and talk to you as well. You know, if 2 kids are going for a job in Belfast and one comes from an interface and one doesn't, the one who doesn't will get the job quicker than the one in the interface, even though they've got the same skills.
Ultimately, she says the decisions about whether the wall should stay or go need to be made by the people who live closest to them and are most directly impacted by the violence.
Ian McLaughlin agrees.
It can't be a top-down approach.
He knows that in a lot of neighborhoods, the idea of removing walls is unpopular, but he thinks it's possible if people move slowly and carefully.
It has to be a process where people can
come together and say, do you know what, guys? Maybe the first step isn't to remove that structure. Maybe the first step is to take away the metal fencing.
Go in stages. Yeah.
And let's see how we get along. Then you go back to the community and say, do you know what? What might we do next here? That could involve, okay, if we take off layers and layers of certain brickwork, and then you have someone say, but yeah, but what's in it for the communities? Is there going to be a play area created for kids? Is there going to be work opportunities for young people to take part in this? All those thoughts have to come into the equation.
Even if it's slow, Ian wants the walls to come down. Eventually. He sees it as a moral imperative, because there are new generations of kids growing up around these structures, and he wonders what ideas they're absorbing from them.
I mean, kids, being the most inquisitive little people, are going to say, Daddy, Mommy, why is that wall there? In this community, you may well be told that wall was put there to stop Catholics attacking your home. And on the other side of the gate, a child might be told, oh, that wall was put there to stop Protestants attacking your home. Now, what are we doing? We're creating the seeds of sectarianism in kids for another generation. How it manifests itself in a generation's time is anybody's guess.
This point hit hardest for me when I visited a guy named Danny Walsh in a Catholic enclave of East Belfast called Short Strand. We stood in front of his house near a wall topped with spikes and painted with grease to prevent people from climbing it. He said it's always felt a bit gloomy knowing he can't interact with people on the other side. But it's the only neighborhood he's ever known.
Do you like living here?
Yeah, 100%. Like I say, I was born in the street and I've known nowhere else. So good neighbors, friendly community.
You have kids, right?
I have two boys, yeah.
How old are they?
One is three and one is coming two.
Do you have any fears of raising them in this neighborhood?
You can hear kids playing football in the background just behind you there. Oh,
hold on. Sorry. And there's ice cream trucks. Like any other neighborhood, there just happens to be a big brick wall with a fence 30 feet high or whatever that is across the street from you. But life goes on.
That's it, yeah.
I was struck by just how ordinary the whole situation seemed. Until Danny pointed out that this ice cream truck never crosses over to the other side of the wall. It's the Catholic truck. The Protestants have their own.
Life goes on in two different worlds. So they have their own ice cream truck and we have ours. And simply because he's known this area. And they have their own at the other side of the wall too. It's a really strange thing.
Thanks so much to 99% Invisible for their enormous help this week, especially my editors Joe Rosenberg and Delaney Hall, editorial guidance by Emmett Fitzgerald and Vivian Lay, mix and tech production was by Sharif Youssef, and original music by Sean Rial. Thanks also to Don Duncan and Marcus Hunter Neal for production assistance, and to Monina O'Prey at the International Fund for Ireland. 99% Invisible has long been one of my favorite programs. Chances are, if you came up to me on the street and asked me to recommend a podcast besides my own, 99PI would probably be near the top of my list, because some of the stories they tell are just so incredibly fascinating. So if you aren't already familiar with it, I urge you to check it out. And if you listen to their episode number 367, the one that contains my story, beginning around 28 and a half minutes in, you could also hear a bonus conversation between Roman and me, where I discuss the connection between Brexit and the peace walls, the ongoing divisions between Catholics and Protestants, and a very funny TV show that's helping to bring the two groups together. To make it easier to find, I've linked to it from my show notes. If you go to my website at farfromhomepodcast.org, you could see some photos from my reporting trip and an interactive map of the peace walls in Belfast. And if you enjoyed this story, please spend some time looking around my site and delving into Far From Home's archives, because I've got 3 seasons of more great episodes. As always, you could also find and follow Far From Home on Instagram and Facebook. You could tweet me at Scott Gurian, and you could also follow the Far From Home Club on Clubhouse. My outro credit music this time was recorded in a pub during my visit to Ireland. Until next time, thanks for listening.